I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back.
We're about to talk about the life from a very interesting perspective of Cesar Chavez. Miriam Powell is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, author of The Union of Their Dreams. She produced this series for the L.A. Times on Cesar Chavez, and out of that has come this book, The Crusades of Cesar Chavez, a biography, that opens things many of us have a hard time thinking about, given who he was to many people in the 60s and 70s as leading of the farm workers, the great boycott that many of us were part of, and just the life he lived. And we are about to talk to the woman who wrote that book, Miriam Powell, who joins us now. Miriam, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thanks, Mark. Thanks for having me.
This was, Miriam, a very tough book.
So I first have to ask you why.
Why did you think you had to tackle this? What drove you to tackle this way, especially after your first book on the farm workers? What was it that pushed you to do this?
So really the reason that I wrote it was because there was no biography that had been written about Cesar Chavez. He's been dead now for just over 21 years. And, you know, people don't know who he was. He has really faded from memory. And while for people of a certain age and a certain generation who were involved in the boycott, he's still a very real presence. When you get particularly outside of California and the Southwest and anyone under the age of 50-something, people don't know who he was. And you know, I mean, Diego Luna did a movie recently that came out,
right.
Chavez, and he did a stunt, kind of. He stood on a street in Austin on Cesar Chavez Boulevard and stopped people and asked them if they knew who he was. And it took about five or six people before anybody had even heard of him, or the people think he's the boxer. There's a famous Mexican boxer by the same name.
That's right, exactly.
So,
right, right.
You know, and Labor Secretary Tom Perez at a screening for the film in Washington said people know he had something to do with farm workers, but they can't get to the second sentence. And so that's really what persuaded me to write the book, was the idea that rather than tarnishing his legacy, and we could talk about why I think that people have been afraid for a long time to write this book, you know, rather than doing that, that in fact writing a comprehensive and serious and scholarly biography would help to restore him to the place in history that he deserved. Because part of the reason people don't know who he is that there has been until recently such a lack of serious scholarship about him. So that's kind of why I wrote it.
I mean, the piece that were written before were very different. I mean, Peter Matheson, who did a blurb, wrote a book many years back, Sol Cipuedes, and the other piece, Delano, a book I still have in my library, was written many years back during the strike. But you're right. I mean, and we didn't know this, but we know Cesar Chavez created a movement that an organized farm workers who were the lowest paid workers here, the Harvest of Shame produced by Edward R. Murrow, put that in the living rooms of Americans across the country in 1960. But Chavez was, you know, those of us know the name. His name is synonymous with what he did to bring this union to fore. But he was a complex man from the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
That's
exactly.
But I wasn't so shocked about some of it. I mean, when you write about how he was in the Navy, and when was he really in the Navy, and all the ways he kind of manipulated his life. Many people do that.
Right. And he did it in the interest of his cause. I mean, I think, and I tried to frame it that way, so that the things that he embellished and changed about his life story, he did always with the idea that they would help him organize and help him reach this goal that was, you know, such an audacious goal, really, to take on. So I agree with you. I think that, I mean, I think as a historian, it's important for those facts to be out there and to be there accurately. And I think he took great pains to preserve the material that would allow us as historians and as future kind of readers to put his life in context and to present it fully and accurately. But I mean, I find the way he created his own mythology to be interesting too. And as you say, many people do that, and they do it in the interest of telling a story that helps to organize people and to get farm workers who, you know, the conditions of farm workers then, and unfortunately to a large extent now as well, but the conditions were horrendous, and people were were very scared, and to persuade workers to join this movement and to risk the precarious livelihood that they had, you know, and I mean, any little tool that he could use was useful.
So one of the things that many people believed about Cesar Chavez, those who knew him when or back in the 60s and 70s, thought of him as a farm worker who came up that way, but he came up a very different way. He didn't just come out of the field. This is as you write about. He learned his organizing in one of the strongest community organizing organizations in the country, and really learned his craft. This was a studied man.
Right, exactly. And I really, you know, you're talking about a period between about 1952 and 1962 when he had an apprenticeship as an organizer under a man named Fred Ross, who is a really important California figure who also nobody's heard of, but and who was funded by Saul Alinsky, whom people have heard of. He did. Chavez did not kind of spring full-born out of the fields and become the leader of the farm workers union. He had this really fascinating kind of 10-year apprenticeship that he documented, too, because he was required to file weekly and monthly and sometimes daily reports for Alinsky. And so there's a real paper trail, a record, where you can read these reports that he wrote and kind of trace his evolution as an organizer and how he really learns that craft, and then how he begins to put his own spin and his own sort of genius for organizing and as a strategist and tactician on that. But yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, because I find that period of his life to be very fascinating. I mean, sort of all of the ways in which he actually kind of learns and cements the craft. And a lot of the things that happened to him during that decade are very directly related to the kinds of shaping the decisions that he makes as the leader of the farm worker union as well.
Talk about those couple of things. This is the important part, I thought. That's why I brought it up first. I mean, obviously it's in the beginning, but which is why I did it as well. But talk about some of those roots that really changed Chavez in the course of his working for the Solinsky-style group at Ross's group, and what happened. I mean, and his decision to leave and go do his own work.
Right. So the Community Service Organization, or the CSO, was really the first grassroots organization for Mexican-Americans in California. And it did things that were sort of designed to empower Mexican-Americans and to bring them into the political process in order to make demands on the system. And it did that through citizenship classes and voter registration campaigns and taking action on behalf of Mexican-Americans who were subject to police brutality and second-class schools and, you know, poor services and so on. So it was really, he learned from Ross this, what sometimes gets called as a Tupperware method of organizing, where you do that, you conduct house meetings. And house meetings would be, I ask you to invite a few friends over to meet me and let me explain what I'm doing in town and how I'm trying to just kind of find out what your problems are and to persuade people that by joining together and acting collectively, they can actually take on political power and influence the process. And it's funny because the CSO was actually kind of endorsed by groups like the Daughters of the American Revolution and other you know, groups that we don't think of as helping Mexican Americans, because it was, the idea was that it was about assimilation, and it was about bringing people into the, making citizens and making Americans out of these Mexicans and so on. And so it had a lot of success and developed chapters, and Chavez's job was to travel around the state and basically sort of set up chapters. And so he did that in some cities, but also in largely in rural and in agricultural areas. And that's where he first kind of encounters the problems of farm workers. And, I mean, he knew those problems firsthand. I mean, we should say that he was a farm worker, and he was a migrant, part of a migrant family from the age of 12 until he's in the Navy and so on. So he knew, he understood, he had a very visceral anger and understanding of the way that farm workers were treated as really the lowest of the low. And not only was the work physically brutal, but they were also treated with a total lack of dignity or respect. And a lot of that sort of drives him. So then when you take this sort of his own personal experience in the field and understanding what it's like to be a Mexican-American farm worker in this day and age, and then combine that with him seeing what the opportunities of getting power are through community organizing. And that's really kind of what that period in his life is about, as he learns to organize, I think. And then, you know, some of the things that come out of that you referred to, the CSO becomes in some ways a victim of its own success, in his view, in that the people who are becoming in power, the Mexican-Americans, are sort of moving into the middle class, many of them. And they begin to embrace middle-class values, and this really upsets him. He has a real disdain for what are middle-class values and believes that people should not live in poverty, they should be comfortable, but they should also remember where they came from and help those who are less fortunate and continue to help them. And as the branches of the CSO, particularly in the more urban areas, become much more interested in sort of middle-class ambitions and moving into running for office and doing things like that, the leadership, he becomes more and more frustrated with this. And he finds himself in this situation where he has empowered people who are now choosing to use that power for goals that he does not share. And that's a really important point because it's a position he never wants to be in, and he sort of vows that he will not be in that position. And the way he will not be in that position is by really maintaining control over the focus and the agenda of the organization he ultimately creates.
So, in many ways, what you're right about here, this is the inkling of what's to come, of who, the inner right. workings on what fuels Cesar Chavez. And I think it's important here to kind of note, too, for people who are just listening, listening to this conversation about Cesar Chavez and organizing Mexican and Filipino farm workers in California back in the late 60s, is that we are not talking about migrants. We're talking about people, for the most part, who were Mexicans who lived in the United States, Mexican-Americans, working in
right.
those fields. And we can talk in a bit about the whole movement he had to even stop migrants from coming across the border, the wet line. But, I mean, so this is very important to establish, I think, who we're talking about here.
Right, that the workforce, I mean, it was a mixed workforce, and there were Mexicans who would come, and particularly it differed from in different crops, too, and it differed with proximity to the border. So in the vegetable fields, in the winter season for growing lettuce and vegetables for much of the country is based in the southern part of California in the Imperial Valley. And so there, because you're right on the border, there is a large Mexican workforce and was at that time, too. So it was kind of a mixture, but in terms of the grapes, which become the thing that people remember, and the grape boycott and the grape contracts and all that, that was primarily a Mexican-American and Filipino workforce. There were Arabs, there were black workers, there were whites. It was kind of a mix, but still predominantly Mexican-American.
So here we have Cesar Chavez going to organize and moving up with his family. And so take us to that point. I think here this is... And the people who come around him very early, like Dolores Huerta and others, become the backbone of this union with him. And I think it's really important that he sees this world as not necessarily organizing union for higher wages,
right?
But something much more complex. But so it takes us to that beginning.
Right. So by the early 1960s, the CSO is kind of in financial trouble, and he's increasingly frustrated both because of the middle-class aspirations of the members and also because he is not in control. He's a staff person. He's working for other people, and so he has he's hamstrung, and he's limited in his ability to set the agenda. And he decides that he wants to go off on his own and try to organize a farm worker union, which is this really remarkably kind of audacious vision. I mean, he was very visionary in a lot of different ways, and his ability to see that this was even possible at that point in time is pretty remarkable, because farm workers were not covered by any labor laws, by health and safety laws. I mean, there was no legal protection to do what he was determined to do. But he leaves what is a secure and relatively well-paying job in April of 1962. He resigns as the director of the CSO, takes his wife and 8 children to Delano, California, which is the part of the table grape industry, takes Delano because he and his wife both have family there, essentially, and he knows that it's kind of the center of a farm worker community, and he begins to just, almost by himself, I mean, with the support of a few people like Dolores Huerta and Gilbert Padilla and his wife, Helen, and many of the people who he had gotten to know and organize in the CSO, ultimately support him in this quest, but essentially by himself drives up and down the valley, stops in these towns, talks to people one-on-one, sets up small committees, and doesn't even tell them that he's trying to organize a labor union, because he knows that that would scare people. So he calls it the Farm Workers Association, and he says that he's just trying to the second question, which I think also kind of just goes to his remarkable vision, is would you be interested in a newspaper for farm workers to tell people things that are important to them? And so, you know, the idea that a newspaper could become an effective organizing tool for a population, many of whom were illiterate and not bilingual either, is kind of, a testament to his eccentric imagination in some ways. So he does this starts this in April of 62. It is, I think, his, in many ways, you know, one of his most brave and admirable moments and courageous. And writes these letters to Fred Ross, his mentor, during that period, where you really see kind of how scared and vulnerable he is, in a sense, too, as he tries to do this thing that he recognizes how hard this is. And by September of 62, has succeeded in organizing enough people that he calls a convention. And September 30th, 1962 is the first convention of what ultimately becomes the United Farm Workers. And they adopt the black eagle as the flag and Viva La Causa as the motto, and they vote to contribute monthly dues. And that's the birth of the Farm Workers Union.
And the newspaper you're talking about, El Macriado, is really an amazing paper.
It was remarkable.
And I think that let's hit a couple of really important points here, I think, because I want to talk about the remarkable for a moment with you about, I mean, the remarkable about Cesar Chavez and Dolores Huerta and El Macriado, and not just starting the campaign in these fields, the poorest workers in America, Mexican and Filipino workers in America, in the fields picking grapes and the stuff that people eat across the country. But it goes beyond that. He builds a national movement. He builds an international movement. He's not going to buy labor relations so he can go off and create these boycotts. And he built something incredible that just took the country and world by storm.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, it's a remarkable achievement. And he took the poorest of the poor and took on the most powerful industry in California and was able to succeed. I mean, it's truly a David versus Goliath tale, and he does this by recognizing from the start that he cannot win a strike in the agricultural valleys of California because the growers there control, you know, not only jobs, but the courts, the police, the city hall, and even the church, and the Catholic Church, which ultimately becomes an important force in helping the farm workers, initially does not side with them because the pillars, the financial pillars of the Catholic Church in the valleys are the growers, and they're not going to support the union. So he's taking on this power structure, and he recognizes that he has to do that by going outside the valley and bringing in powerful allies and forming these sort of really key strategic alliances with the other religious movements, with labor leaders, with students, and we should also stop and sort of put this in time. And this is the late 60s. There is the San Francisco Bay Area is a center of, you know, political foment among young people, and that is where the initial support for the strike comes from. And that's sort of the beginning of it. And El Macriado, this newspaper that gets put out by, you know, a couple people initially, and like everything else, is sort of done seat of the pants. El Macriado and the SNCC newspaper, the Students for Nonviolent Coordinating Committee paper that is also coming out of San Francisco called The Movement,
and
the communist newspaper, those become the vehicles for spreading the word about what's happening in Delano. So, you know, even before the strike begins in September of 65, which really sort of starts to put all of this on the national map, even before that, the word is getting out that they are in political circles, and particularly in the Bay Area, that there is this movement starting to go on. There is this new civil rights struggle. You know, you have people who were in the Mississippi summer in 1964 who are coming out of SNCC. SNCC is becoming an increasingly inhospitable place for whites to be. So you have kind of people drifting back to California and looking for the next big fight, and here it is. It's the farm workers. So, you know, again, this just as he didn't sort of spring suddenly, you know, full-born as an organizer, the movement doesn't start, you know, just when the strike begins either. There's a lot that's kind of been put in place so that there is a climate of readiness to support this movement. And then he builds it from there. And we should talk about the boycott because it is
what most
people remember in it, and it's what turns this into sort of a national and international cause. And, you know, again, it's kind of remarkable they're not winning the strike in the field. It's very hard to win a strike at all with farm workers when you think about, I mean, it's such an untraditional strike. There isn't a plant where people are coming in and out. There are, you know, hundreds of acres of fields. Their crews move around. I mean, it's difficult to even know where to put a picket line. So it's very hard to, you know, have an effective strike in the field under any circumstances. And so he then kind of says, well, you know, if we can't stop the grapes being produced, we can try to stop them at the other end and try to affect the grower's ability to sell them. And this kind of begins, again, through SNCC largely and through some of the other civil rights groups that are trying to help boycott liquor brands of liquor that are made with certain grapes and so on. But what really turns the boycott into what it becomes is his decision to send farm workers to cities around the country, and many of them are people who don't speak English, haven't been on a plane, haven't been outside California and Mexico, and they get sent to Detroit and Pittsburgh and Chicago and Miami and Baltimore. I mean, Baltimore and Washington were a big boycott area, and just kind of told, you know, here's $100 and here's the name of somebody who's going to pick you up at the airport who's a labor person who will help you find a place to stay. And your job is to convince supermarkets not to sell grapes. So, you know, I mean, on the face of it, this sounds kind of crazy. And the remarkable part, you know, is that it worked, right? And it works because, obviously, the farm workers don't do it alone. They do find, you know, powerful and institutional allies, particularly in labor and in the church and in student movements. But it also works because these farm workers become the public face of the strike and the movement. And, you know, here I am, I'm a 19-year-old farm worker from Delano, California, and I've left my family and I've quit my job and I'm living on $5 a week and I'm here to ask you to just, you know, please do this little thing, don't buy grapes, to help the farm workers in California. And, you know, it takes off. It becomes a way for people, I mean, it does something that is the Grapes of Wrath, and then Edward R. Murrow's documentary that in 1960 did. I mean, every so often there is something that puts farm workers into the public consciousness in a way that they normally are not, because they're normally very invisible to people. And this was a way, a very powerful way of doing that and of, you know, gathering support. And it was also sort of this genius because it allowed people to do something and to feel they were joining this movement and to feel good about themselves and to do this small thing of not eating grapes or wearing a button or marching in a picket line or whatever their level of commitment would be, where they could feel that they were sort of doing something good for people who really needed it, contributing. And it was a remarkable movement.
And I think that within this is the part I think that is so interesting, that the picture painted of Cesar Chavez, of the book you write about him. I think that you can look at what you've written about Cesar Chavez and you can go, oh, no, you're destroying who this human being is. You're laying bare all of his weaknesses to destroy the hero that has these buildings named after him, that those who do remember as his great revolutionary leader. But I think that if you look at it in the context of the whole book, I'm going to throw this out to you. I mean, I think that you have Cesar Chavez here is this – he was two people. I mean, he was many people, like we all are. But he was this man who comes out of this rich Catholic tradition, who believed in penitence and believed in the power of poverty and of change and of living a certain kind of almost monastic life. On the other hand, you have this labor leader who wants to form this union of poor people across America, much like King did in some ways, but is not about being the traditional union leader, which is where he came to conflict later, because he wasn't pushing for higher wages and making people middle class. He was trying something very different. He was a man of this master contradictions that I think fueled all the contradictions that you lay out in the book.
Right. Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, but I don't see them as contradictory. I mean, he's
all right.
They're complexities, right?
That's a better word. Complexities is,
yeah,
a better word.
You know,
yes. Right.
Yeah. Because
right,
he's not. I think in many ways he's kind of remarkably consistent in what his vision is and how he's moving toward it. And you can agree. And one of the things I try to do in the book is to say, you know, here are the things that you know, here is what his vision was, and here is why he took the actions he did. Now, you as a reader and you as a certainly participants in the movement may disagree with some of the things he did and say, why did he do that? You know, in effect, in many ways, he ultimately destroys the union he created. But you should understand from reading, you know, once you read the book, I think, that he has this vision that drives him, and that you have to respect that, and that's who he was. And I don't, you know, I think that we sometimes want our heroes to be perfect people, and that's not what heroes are. I mean, heroes are complicated. Heroes have strengths and weaknesses, and he did too. So I think that by writing about him in all of his complexity, it shows his humanity, and I don't think it takes away from his remarkable accomplishments or from his legacy, which is not particularly a legacy in the field, but is a legacy in many other ways in terms of, I think, ongoing struggles for social justice, and his importance as a hero for Latinos, and that's a real role. But that doesn't mean that he has to be some, you know, one-dimensional saint-like figure.
Right. Exactly. I'm talking with Miriam Powell about her latest book, The Crusades of Cesar Chavez, a biography. We have to take a very short break, but when we come back, we'll hear the rest of the conversation with Miriam Powell. I'm Mark Steiner, and I'm about to talk to Miriam Powell about her latest book, The Crusades of Cesar Chavez, a biography. She's a Pulitzer Prize-winning author and reporter who spent 25 years at Newsday and the Los Angeles Times.
Before we get to kind of the implosion of the movement itself, it was really interesting to me that towards the beginning of the book, when you write about somebody who I'd never heard of, Donna Haber, but of course I knew who Luis Valdez was, and Teatro Campesino, which we can talk about for a moment. But when you write about that in the beginning of the book, and Teatro Campesino, of course, is still alive as an organization, is still doing work, and,
yep.
And Luis Valdez is still doing his work as a creative genius,
yes.
in theater, in poor people's, yes. theater. But what was interesting to me, that here were the seeds of what was going to come later.
Yes.
And his confrontation. Yes. I really didn't know until I looked at read your book, because I'd seen Teatro Campesino perform years and years back and knew their work and copied some of our work after them. But I had no idea of the split.
Right.
And what happened.
And it's never, right. And it's never been talked about. And I did this great program at the Los Angeles Library with Luis Valdez, which was just so much fun and a great event, where he talked to, for the first time publicly, about being purged. I mean,
yeah, I was shocked.
And the Teatro or the first group, because he never talked, you know, I mean, part of it is the movement ethos that you don't talk about those things.
Right.
You know,
right.
And many people didn't. But I mean, for Luis, it's also complicated because his relationship to Caesar is, you know, an incredibly important one in his life. And I think, like many people, there's a degree to which he was always and continues to wrestle with what that relationship really was. And has been cast out, even though he was, of the people who were cast out, he had already an independent constituency and a base and a career and a future, and preserved, you know, over the years, a good working relationship with Chavez and with the movement, and continued to act on behalf of it. But, I mean, it was an incredibly painful moment, and for him and everyone involved, and I think that sort of in the summer of 1967, you know, you have this first generation of volunteers who come when the strike starts, and from 65 to 67, they just show up and they work for free, and they're, you know, and they're very ideological, most of them, and they're coming out of the anti-war movement and out of the civil rights movement, and they're strong, independent-minded thinkers, and at some point, Chavez decides that, you know, that we don't need this anymore. There are plenty of people we can get, and we need people who are not going to argue so much with me. I mean, essentially, to some degree, I mean, people who are going to be more, you know, loyalty. I mean, loyalty
pliable.
Emerges, I think, more pliable. Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Right.
And I think that, you know, and again, there's a lot of sides to this. I mean, anyone who's tried to run an organization and been democratic, and it's like at some point you just want to say, like, you know, enough already. Just shut up. Let's just do what I say. And there's a big element of that, and it kind of, you know, the more you have people around who are acolytes, the easier it is to fall into that role also. And so people who are independent and strong-minded and have an independent base and constituency, there's no place for them in the movement. And, you know, and there's an element of, I mean, the teatro was very important for the union. It both as an organizing tool, and it was, you know, immensely popular among workers, and it also was a fundraising vehicle. So, you know, the decision to get rid of them has a cost, but it's sort of very clear that loyalty has already emerged as the key, loyalty and single-minded commitment to, you know, the cause as I, Cesar Chavez, define it from the start. There's this little detail in that 67 purge that I find so telling, which is that one of the other people who was purged at that point is a doctor,
right,
who had wanted to set up a clinic and had argued with Cesar about where the clinic should be and who it should treat. And one of the strongest women on the picket line, one of the few Mexican-American women actually who was could stay out on strike and was a real picket captain, he was her personal doctor as well. And she gets told at a board meeting, you know, you have to drop him as your doctor or leave the union. And it's that, and you see that then develop over time, kind of that loyalty to everyone. Sooner or later, there's that kind of, you know, if you are with us and if this is the most important thing in your life, then you have to stop whatever, you know, stop playing the cello or stop going to college or, you know, whatever the individual situation becomes. But that loyalty pledge kind of becomes more and more important.
So if we take that now, I mean, I think it's important to lay what you just laid out and how you laid it out with El Teatro Campesino, because I think that it's important to hear the Valdez and many of the other people that he had confrontation with never really left the struggle.
Right.
And this, so it's a really important thing to kind of play out here, because you, leading into the implosion, I mean, there are people here like who really fought for the union democracy on the inside and did so much work, like Alicio Medina, who actually came from the fields, Gilbert Padilla, Chavez's dear friend, and what happened there, his own battles with his brother, in the union, and to that's this kind that's where the implosion begins, where some of those powerful people in the union, the best organizers I had, were literally pushed out.
Right. They were literally pushed out, and they, you know, some in very public and painful ways, but many in the way that Tony Orendain, who was also one of the early organizers and ends up in Texas and also pushed out, used to say that Cesar never actually fires anyone. He just opens all the doors and windows and waits for you to leave.
And, right, right.
That's a very good description. You
right,
know, it's sort
right,
of he would,
right.
And sometimes he waited. Sometimes he targeted someone and he knew they were going to go, and he waited for the right opportunity to force the issue. And, you know, he was able to make life uncomfortable enough that people sooner or later saw. And, you know, for many people, I mean, there were many people who envisioned spending their life on this cause and who cared deeply, deeply, deeply about the farm workers. And so, it was really a wrenching experience for them, but they still believed that this was the best hope for improving the lives of farm workers. So very few people talked publicly for many, many, many years about what had happened because they, you know, didn't want to do anything that might hurt the cause.
So what, give us, I mean, we could spend hours talking about this particular piece, but I think it's important to kind of lay out for our listeners as we talk about Cesar Chavez and your really incredible book, just in terms of the work you put into this and the writing, what it opened up. But there came a point in Cesar Chavez's life where he moves the headquarters from this place that was really important to this place in the mountains, which you can talk about, and gets involved with Sinanon and gets involved in this kind of, I remember all these kind of different cultish kind of things that came out of the early 70s, you know, that in the 60s that people put the game and all the other things people did, that he fell into this world. And that was a big part of what happened here. This is also maybe his own wrestling with himself about who he was and what he really wanted and what he thought people should want.
I think that, all of those things are very on target. And the decision, I mean, early, he you know, again, it's kind of, there are the seeds of things that come up later that people in retrospect look back and say, well, yes, you know, the decision in 1971, which was still, you know, a high point for the Union in many ways. They had just won this enormous victory in the boycott and signed contracts in 1970 with virtually all the grape growers in California, which was, by the way, the Union never again had as many members as it did in the summer of 1970. And just at that point, he moved the headquarters from Delano, which is the heart of the table grape industry, to a place called Keene, California, which is about 30 miles east of Bakersfield and has now actually recently become a National Historic Monument. It's part of the National Park Service now, and it becomes the headquarters of the Union. And it is a former tuberculosis sanatorium in the foothills of the Tehachapi Mountains. Very beautiful, very remote, not near anything. I mean, really the middle of nowhere. And it is a place that can house hundreds of people, and on some points does. And Travis sees this as a place that can be a community. And that was the appeal. I mean, he first talks about it as an educational retreat. We'll bring people here, and we'll bring farm workers here, and we'll have classes. But then over time, this really, what becomes important to him is the idea to try to form a community. And he very early on even talks about he's interested in kibbutzim and in collectives and in ways of forming communities, because he sees that as the alternative to living in poverty or becoming middle class. I mean, this is sort of the middle ground. We can have people live in communities where they have their needs are taken care of, they're comfortable, they're living in dignity, and yet there is this collective sacrifice, and there is it's a way to avoid the pitfalls, as he sees them, of the middle class. So he begins to, over time, kind of experiment with the idea of turning La Paz, which is the name of the headquarters, into this kind of a community. It has all these run-down, horrible, you know, the heat never works, and people, I mean, but it's sort of for young people who are committed to the cause. You just go there and you live at La Paz. And so it becomes this community, and he, you know, he even talks at certain points about trying to form a religious order for farm workers. So he does go off and kind of explore all of that, even as, and in some ways, particularly as the Union, as a traditional labor union, is having its greatest success. Because fundamentally, the business of running the union, when you have to, you know, go out and win an election and then negotiate a contract and then administer the contract, and there's a health plan that has to be run, and all of those sort of bureaucratic things do not interest him. And he's very clear about that. He calls it non-missionary work. And so the more that the union becomes successful, and particularly after 1975, which I think is kind of an important dividing line, because in 1975, the union achieved its greatest political and legislative success, which is the passage of the California Agricultural Labor Relations Act,
right,
in large part because of young Governor Jerry Brown, the first time around. And that law gives farm workers basic rights that they are denied in the rest of the country, really, because farm workers are not covered under the National Labor Relations Act, so have no right to organize or no protected union activity. And so it sets up this mechanism for elections, and then there are elections, and then there are contracts and all of that. And the more that happens, the more that Chavez tries to find the movement part and how to preserve the movement spirit, and gets more and more involved in the other side of it. And that leads him to things like Sinanon, which, it was pretty wacky then, even, but it sounds even wackier now outside of the context of Esalon in the 60s and 70s and encounter groups and all the rest of that. But it appeals to him because it's this kind of planned, controlled community.
So I wonder if you could just, I'm really curious about this, and I know that you kind of sum some of this up a little bit in the book, but I'm like to delve a little bit deeper into it. I'm curious what comes out of this for you. What came out of all these years of research, all this time writing about Cesar Chavez? Clearly you're very passionate about this subject from the way you wrote the book. So what comes out of it for you, and what do you think it says to us now in this century?
Right. So, you know, what got me into this was meeting the people who came out of the movement. and that was my starting point, and that was what led me to the first book, which is really more about the other people in the movement and their experience and the view through them. And so, you know, as I met people who, it's a funny time period that we're talking about, because it's long ago enough that it's history, and people now view it as history and are more willing to talk about it for that reason. And yet there still are a lot of people around who lived through much of this period. So as a historian, it's kind of an interesting mix of being able to do, you know, oral history and rely very heavily on primary source documents and tapes and so on. And but, you know, as I met these people, it was sort of like they were still just traumatized to some degree by events that had taken place 30 and 40 years ago. And they just were, I mean, I would say people were haunted by the decisions that had been made then and by what went wrong with the farm workers movement. And, I mean, with you know, why were we unable to form a lasting union for farm workers? And I think it was kind of their passion for this that drew me in the sense of wanting to understand what was this movement and what was such a powerful force that it changed all of these people's lives. And that, you know, I mean, I have yet to meet anyone who worked for the UFLW for any period of time, and no matter what circumstances they left under, and many of them, you know, did not leave under happy circumstances, who doesn't say that it was the most important part of their life and formed, you know, who they are today and shaped them, and that they would do it again. So what drew me in was wanting to understand, you know, what was this force, and then, you know, in some ways I think I kind of get closer and closer into the center of it, get, you know, drawn by centrifugal force, if you will, because, you know, the first book for me was wanting to kind of understand who those people were, what their stories were, and tell the story of the movement through their eyes. And so in The Union of Their Dreams, Cesar Chavez is a central figure, obviously, but you're seeing him kind of through the other characters, really. And then, you know, I wasn't going to write the book. I mean, I had no plans to write a biography, and then people kept saying to me, you should write it because there is none. And then I also kind of thought, as I got more distance from the first book, that, you know, ultimately I wanted to understand more about who he was, because, you know, he is at the center of all of this, and he did create it, and to some extent he destroyed it, parts of it. So that's that, you know. But not other parts, and there are many parts of his legacy. And so, the second part of your question, I think that his legacy is in many ways more relevant now than ever, at a point in time where traditional modes of organizing for people, and particularly for labor unions, are increasingly failing. And that people are looking for new ways to organized for progressive social causes. And I think that a lot of the things that he did, that the models for that, are in a lot of what he did. And you see, to some degree, that showing up in various places, in the work of the Coalition of Immokalee Workers in Florida, and in some of the immigrant rights movement. And so a lot of ultimately what he showed us was that the poorest people, by effectively organizing and working together and using, you know, really smart strategies, could take on the most powerful institutions and prevail. And even when they had nothing to give to the cause other than, you know, their own bodies and their own lives in many ways. And that's something that outlasts him, and I think he understood that too. You know, he gave a very prophetic speech in 1984 at a point when the union was already in fairly steep decline, and when Ronald Reagan had just been reelected president in a landslide, so it was not an optimistic time politically. And he stood up at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco and said, basically, it doesn't matter what happens from now on, because what we have shown is just beginning to be understood in the cities around California and around the country, and both in terms of he understood at that point it's the importance for Latinos, or for Hispanics, as he called them, that if the farm workers could do it, we can do it too. And that sort of the si se puede spirit, if you will, was was an important part of his legacy, and that was going to continue. And I think it has. And I think that the people who came out, you know, the tragedy for many people, and particularly for people who were involved in deeply in the farm worker struggle, the tragedy is the conditions in the fields are not a whole lot better today, and that there is no effective union for farm workers. But the legacy of the people who learned to organize and either directly from Chavez or from people around him and who sort of caught that spirit, they've gone on and they're working in sort of all sorts of other fields in different forms of fighting for social justice. And they have trained, you know, another generation that is picking up those lessons. So
right.
I think a lot of that, you know, that is his legacy, and that resounds. And it's really important that at this point in time, when people are not, you know, labor unions are not an effective force. So.
That's very poignant. And Miriam Paul, I really want to thank you for the book. You wrote it with great sensitivity and a sense of. Of belief as well that undergirded what could have been kind of a slam, and it was not. It was just opening up the doors to what reality is for us all.
Right.
So the Crusades of Cesar Chavez biography. Miriam Powell, thank you so much. It was wonderful to talk to you. It was a wonderful book.
Thank you so much.